Today I'm talking about Denis or Denis Diderot, whose picture you see on the playbill. He was a contemporary of Voltaire and Rousseau. He was part of a group called the Philosophes, or philosophers. They were people thinking and writing about politics, religion, literature, art, society in pre-revolutionary France. He's less well known than the others. Partly that's because he chose to modify or withhold many of his advanced ideas. At a time when publishing criticism of the political or religious establishment could lead to imprisonment, exile, or death, he had to choose carefully what to publish. But he knew he was writing for posterity. Before his death, he had multiple copies produced of an astounding range of writing. These weren't published till after the French Revolution, and some as late as 1890, over 100 years past his death. So they were a significant influence on readers, writers, and thinkers throughout the 19th century. Diderot was interested in everything, somewhat like Leonardo da Vinci. He wrote 7,000 different articles for his encyclopedia. Goethe never met him, but he mentioned in one of his letters that Diderot was known for his witty and knowledgeable conversation. Rousseau, who knew him well, called him an astonishing, universal, perhaps singular genius. Voltaire described him as a pantophile, someone who falls in love with everything he studies. Curran describes a typical day thus. He was a man who might write on ancient Chinese and Greek music first thing in the morning, study the mechanics of a cotton mill until noon, help purchase some paintings for Catherine the Great in the afternoon, and then return home and compose a play and a 20-page letter to his mistress in the evening. Now, did any of you watch the recent documentary by Ken Burns about Benjamin Franklin? It was pretty much the same lifetime that they lived and the same type of genius all over the place for both abstract ideas and inventions. So we do have some slides. I'm not sure where we are with that. Is that already on there? Oh, we're already there. You're ahead of me. Diderot was born in the small town in the provinces named Langres in 1713. And on the next one, you'll see a statue of him that was erected later. And you might be able to see here, he's facing away from the local cathedral. And on the next slide, so sorry, these may not come out that well. It's so bright today. There's a picture of a cutler's workshop. His father was in the trade of making knives. But apparently Diderot's intelligence was recognized early, and he was sent to study on the one path that was available to a working-class family, the priesthood. And this was true with Franklin, too. The first education was in the church. So he learned French, Latin, Greek, literature, philosophy, and rhetoric, and he was on track to becoming a local church official, a canon, C-A-N-O-N. And the family thought he was all set because they had a cousin who was going to retire from ill health, and you could just slide this young man in. Well, the local cathedral didn't approve of that nepotism. Maybe they had someone else in mind. The cousin went so far as to write to the Pope in Denis' favor, but he died. The cousin died before the letter reached Rome. The office was filled with someone else. So whatever career Diderot might have had in the church was cut off. Diderot was a smart aleck as a student. So here's a picture of one of the schools he attended. He would correct his teachers on tricky points of Latin and Greek. He regularly got in trouble for fighting with other boys. On one occasion, he was sent home for this, only to realize he would be missing that day of competition for prizes. He tried to sneak back into the school. He tussled with a guard who actually wounded the boy with a knife. Undaunted, Diderot went in, competed, and won multiple prizes. He later wrote, "I remember this moment as if it were yesterday. I arrived home from school, my arms filled with prizes that I had won, my shoulders covered with crowns that had been bestowed on me." So maybe they made a wreath or something, or a paper crown. "But because they were too big for my brow, they had slipped over my head. My father saw me from afar, stopped work, walked into the doorway, and began to cry. It is a beautiful thing to see an honest, austere man cry." So the biographer Andrew Curran, who wrote this book, says, "Two of Diderot's most deep-rooted tendencies are present in this telling story. his eternal struggle against various forms of authority, and the deep respect and admiration that he felt for his father. For further study, the place to go was to the Jesuits in Paris. So at about 16, Diderot took a coach to this Collège d'Harcourt. Education there was strict and boring. It involved copying and memorizing lessons and attending multiple chapel services daily. And Curran says of Diderot, later in life, he often maligned the repetitive and reclusive world of the religious colleges into which, as he put it, some of his best years had vanished. After 5 years, the students could apply for an ecclesiastical position, but Diderot declined to do this. He also showed little inclination for other professions. He worked 2 years for a solicitor, but he spent most of his time teaching himself new languages and mathematics. Diderot's father, who was supporting him, demanded he choose a profession, and Diderot replied, the profession of doctor did not appeal because he did not want to kill anyone. The profession of solicitor was too difficult to perform scrupulously. That is, I guess he thought that all solicitors were crooked. He would gladly choose the position of lawyer, except that he had an indomitable distaste for taking care of others' affairs. When his father asked what he wanted to do with his life, he replied, my gosh, nothing at all. I like to study. I'm very happy. I don't ask for anything else. Unfortunately, then as now, the profession of eternal student wasn't a realistic choice. And that's very different from Franklin, who apparently was extremely industrious and motivated. Well, Diderot became a well-paid live-in tutor. This seemed like a good job. But he quit after 3 months, saying he could no longer stand being cooped up with only children to talk to. In disgust, his father cut off his allowance, though his mother sometimes had money sent to him secretly. But Diderot was a survivor. He wrote and sold sermons to missionaries. He also didn't let scruples stand in the way of making money. He approached a distant relative in Paris who was a monk. Diderot claimed he wanted to become a monk, but he needed money to pay off his worldly debts. He kept going back to the monk with more excuses why he needed money. Eventually, he got thousands of francs. Finally, the monk declined to advance anymore. So Diderot exclaimed, I no longer wish to become a monk, and he stormed off without paying back a penny. The monk wrote to Diderot's father, who had already paid off some of his son's other debts. Now he reimbursed the gullible monk and warned him he shouldn't have trusted that unreliable boy. Well, Diderot was advancing his education, not just through study, but through new acquaintances. I think the next slide here. Yeah, for instance, the Swiss-born Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And Diderot had discovered women. Antoinette, or Toinette, as he called her, was the daughter of a minor noble who had lost his fortune and died. His widow and daughter survived by running a laundry service. Diderot wormed his way into the family by claiming to be a future priest. He eventually won over both daughter and mother, and then he went home for the first time in over 10 years to ask for his father's permission and financial support. At this time, the age parental consent was required until the age of 30. Excuse me. The senior Diderot did not approve of a wife with no dowry and no position, and with Diderot's request that his father support the family. After a furious argument, the father had Diderot locked up in a nearby monastery. This was also within parental rights of the era. After a few days, the young man escaped through a window, walked 120 kilometers, and then boarded a coach to Paris. Without any more income, Diderot had to move to a squalid apartment. Antoinette refused to marry him while his family disapproved. Diderot was actually saved by a serious illness, perhaps induced by his unhealthy living quarters. When Toinette and her mother found out how sick he was, they rushed to nurse him back to health, and the betrothal was back on. They married in 1743 when Diderot had finally turned 30. Diderot's parents were disturbed not only by the marriage, but reports that their son was turning into one of those Parisian free thinkers. Well, Diderot had always been too smart to accept things at face value. Even as a student, he had been troubled by inconsistencies in Christian dogma. And he saw so many examples of the bad effects of religion in the world. In France, long and bloody wars had split the Catholics and the Huguenot Protestants. How could a benevolent Father God allow such hatred in his name? As he was reading widely, some of his new influences were Spinoza, who denied the possibility that God could exist outside the boundaries of nature and philosophy. There was the French writer Jean Méliès, who stated that the entire Catholic religion was a human fabrication. Diderot taught himself English and read Bacon, Locke, and Newton. Newton championed what was called the argument from design, that the complexity of nature and the universe could not exist without a God to create it. And this attempt to reconcile religion and science was very popular at the time. There was an image of God as the giant clockmaker. Diderot's personal life wasn't going too well. The couple had a daughter, but she died at 6 weeks. And Diderot was already tiring of the wife he had tried so hard to possess. He was a man who fell in love passionately many times, although he continued to care for Toinette and he stayed with her his whole life. His new mistress, Madeleine, was more of an equal in the life of the mind. They exchanged writing and collaborated. And Madeleine encouraged Denis to publish his first book, Pensées philosophiques, or Philosophical Thoughts. Wisely, it was published anonymously. The essays use wit to oppose the bleak theories of Hobbes or Pascal about human life being miserable due to our innate sin, and a focus on our need to confront the terrors of hell. Diderot asked how a caring God could be so vengeful and cruel. He wrote, "The most decent soul would be tempted to wish that this God did not exist." At this point, Diderot didn't consider himself an atheist, but a skeptic. He himself wrote, "Skepticism is the first step toward truth." Religious leaders condemned the book and had it publicly burned. Several wrote lengthy attacks. As happens today, this was great publicity, and the book sold briskly. Even though his first few books were published anonymously, Diderot wasn't shy about his opinions in public, which meant the authorities soon had a file on him. There was no separation between the official Catholic Church and the laws and punishments of the state. And those in power realized that questioning the divine order in the world could lead to questioning the divine right of kings. Diderot was imprisoned by a lettre de cachet. This was something the king could put out that could detain anyone indefinitely, even for life, without a trial. And on the next slide, you'll see where he was locked up in the Chateau de Vincennes. Diderot at first denied publishing any of the works he was accused of, even those he actually did write. They accused him of many he didn't write. But after several weeks in solitary confinement, he broke down and admitted to having written certain books. He apologized and promised not to write anything else controversial. After that, he was moved to more comfortable quarters and given the right to visitors. So his wife visited and some of his co-writers on the encyclopedia, which he had recently started. He had an emotional reunion with his friend Rousseau. And during that visit, Diderot gave Rousseau advice on the essay that was to make Rousseau famous. After 102 days in prison, Diderot was released after signing a statement promising never again to publish heretical works. From then on, he had to couch his views in various forms, or he had to write them up and keep them in a drawer. Well, the plan for this encyclopedia had begun under different leadership back in 1745, but it only took off when Diderot, now 33, and Jean d'Alembert at 29, who's on the next slide, they took charge. The vision was very ambitious, to include articles on the arts, sciences, philosophical, and societal issues. There had been dictionaries, but nothing like this. Diderot was a skilled marketer, even if that meant exaggerating. He put out publicity announcing the completion of the work when it was still in the middle of composition. He promised 8 volumes and 600 illustrations. And on the next slide, we see something from it. This is a title page of the encyclopedia on the left here, which you can't see in any detail. It was a system for the organization of the different areas of knowledge of human beings. They used over 150 writers from every field of science, medicine, literature, and more, 14 artists, draftsmen, and engravers. In the long run, though, Diderot himself wrote over 2,000 articles in the first volume alone, and some of the subjects were geography, childbirth, botany, mythology, carpentry, gardening, architecture, geography, and literature. There was no way a government censor was going to read every word of this huge volume, so Diderot sneaked in some commentary in small ways. For example, under the heading of cannibals, cross-references directed the reader to see communion and Eucharist. They also turned straight articles into absurdities by their length and precision. For example, an article on Noah's Ark of 5,000 words goes into meticulous detail about exactly how much wood was used and how the manure produced by the animals was to be disposed of. Many of the articles were signed, but some were not. In an unsigned article, Diderot wrote on the topic of political authority. No man has received from nature the right to command other men. Freedom is a gift from the heavens, and each individual of the same species has the right to enjoy it. Diderot asserted that the right to govern stems from the people, and this provided the basis for the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which was to come later, and the Declaration of Independence. Now, the illustrations in the Encyclopédie did more than show the outward view. As I was showing before, they had these diagrams showing how things were done, how different machines worked. And you can look at this if you like. Afterwards. Here's the butcher. There's just all sorts of trades. This book is available through the South Central Library System. And this is just one book showing some of the plates. The books with the plates actually are used by some historical societies if they want to do a display, for instance, on printing presses at the time of the American Revolution, or they want to set up their period rooms to look correct. And the idea was to pull back the world's curtain, show you what's inside. When the first two volumes were published, let me see the next slide here. I think there might be some pictures there, which again, yeah, this would be not going to show up too well today, but you could look at this book afterwards. When the first two volumes were published, the strongest resistance came not from the government, but from the Jesuits. Several articles had criticized them, for instance, for the type of stultifying education Diderot himself had endured. He probably wrote that. Perhaps what saved Diderot was the favor and patronage of some important court figures. On the next slide, we'll see Louis XV's mistress, Madame de Pompadour. She was a backer of it. And on the next slide, the official royal censor, Guillaume de Malherbe, surprisingly, was a younger and more enlightened member of the aristocracy, and he supported this enterprise of the encyclopedia. However, there was still enough discontent to attract the attention of the king. Fortunately, he chose not to lock up Diderot and the other editors, but he ordered that all remaining manuscripts of the Encyclopédie be impounded. But it seems that Malherbe, this censor, warned Diderot, who made sure that by the time the authorities arrived at the print shop, there were no copies to be found. A compromise was set up where the first two volumes would remain officially forbidden, but new volumes could come out with an additional layer of government review. Well, all that publicity about the banning of the work again drove up demand, and new subscriptions poured in. The final print run came to over 4,000 copies, which seems quite a lot for the population of the time who could read. And because it was subscription, people paid up front. Diderot's private life wasn't running as smoothly. He and Toinette had four children in all, but they were unfortunate. Their daughter Angélique had died at 1 month, their son, François-Jacques, at 4 years. The next son, Denis Laurent, was being baptized when his godmother dropped him on his head on the stone steps of the church, and he died soon after. Finally, a daughter, Marie-Angélique, was born in 1753. She was the only one to survive into adulthood, and she was very close to her doting father. The success of his work had allowed Diderot to negotiate a more favorable contract, and the family could move to a larger apartment in a better neighborhood with a separate study where Diderot was to work for the next 30 years. In the next few years, as various thinkers and writers continued to question religious and governmental authorities, blame often descended on Diderot, even for articles he didn't write. The Catholic Church put the Encyclopédie on the index, that is, the list of forbidden publications. And the king again ordered manuscripts to be destroyed, but again, Diderot was warned, and multiple boxes of wooden crates were moved before the censor's people showed up. Diderot's next project was to revolutionize the theater. So on the next slide, we'll see a picture here. Again, we may not see it that clearly, but Most of the French drama up to this time was based on historical and mythological subjects. It was delivered in a stylized manner, in a prescribed meter. Diderot's goal was to put regular people on stage and present moral dramas with emotional impact. He wanted to produce the equivalent of the bourgeois paintings of an artist named Greuze, and this is a painting of a marriage contract, just an interior of a bourgeois family. So in his desires, he was actually about 75 years ahead of the Romantics, who had similar goals to liberate the French theater from these classical restraints. However, the dramas read today strike us as sentimental and heavy-handed, and they are no longer put on. Around the same time, Diderot wrote one of his most famous works, Rameau's Nephew. It's presented as a dialogue between two characters debating religion and atheism. The character designated as Me presents the view of the mature Diderot, and I would say this was a humanist view. He said, "All humans are inescapably drawn to the beauty of doing good. People became virtuous, not because someone had scribbled down some guidelines on a scroll 2,000 years before, but because moral actions themselves were beautiful, a natural extension of truth, beauty, and the good. But the other part is taken by a hedonist who recommends enjoying the material pleasures of life, even taking advantage of others whenever he can. He claims that virtues are just vanity. We follow them in order to make ourselves look good." The essay satirizes politicians, financiers, and even musicians. Diderot knew he could never publish this work. He had one copy sent to a friend, he gave one to his daughter, and a third was sent to Catherine the Great, who I'll talk about shortly. These manuscripts were later discovered by writers and thinkers like Friedrich Schiller in Germany. Diderot's interests continued to be wide-ranging. On the next slide, you'll see a picture of, I think, an art salon. Now, this is how paintings were displayed all the way up to, if you read about the Impressionists and the salons that they wanted to enter, that they were usually turned away from, they would display many, many pictures in one room like this. Diderot had become an art critic and art historian. He wrote about the reviews. He wrote reviews about exhibitions. Some of his other interests, he proposed an early version of the evolution of species, placing humans as just one species of many. He had a primitive theory of genetics, stating that various threads control the development of organs and abilities. He presaged Freud in declaring that human beings were constantly embracing, concealing, or reacting against the natural impulses of sexuality. Diderot wrote, "Nothing that exists can be against nature or outside nature." He protested against the strict division of sexes by declaring, "We are all hermaphrodites." In 1762, when Diderot was 49 years old, the Empress Catherine of Russia, who's on the next slide, led a successful coup d'etat against her husband, Peter III. Among the first things that the new empress did after coming to power was to reach out to the French luminaries whom she had so admired. She was a great fan of this encyclopedia project. She invited Diderot to visit, and he felt he couldn't leave France at the time. He was usually short of money, and now he had to start accumulating a dowry for his daughter. He began to hint around that he'd be willing to sell his large collection of books. When word of this reached Empress Catherine, she not only offered a generous price, but included two stipulations. The first was that Diderot was to remain in possession of the books throughout his lifetime, and the second was she appointed Diderot as curator of his own library with a generous annual salary. When there was a delay in the first year's salary, Catherine decided to pay him for 50 years in advance, when he would have been 102. The amount he received was equivalent to about $700,000 today. So basically, she became his patron. He didn't have to worry about money. In gratitude, Diderot assisted Catherine in several ways. He helped artists, teachers, and other luminaries to settle in St. Petersburg, including the sculptor who made the statue of Peter the Great that still stands. He was her official art buyer, sending her the masterpieces that now make up the core of the famous Hermitage Museum. He finally went to St. Petersburg in 1773. He wanted to encourage Catherine in political reforms she was undertaking. During his stay, Diderot would often meet with Catherine three or four times a week in her study, and Curran says, "During sometimes heated exchanges, The philosophe cajoled, contradicted, and even reached out and pounded on Catherine's leg. In a letter that the Empress sent to Voltaire in January 1774, she admitted to being impressed by the limitless imagination of the most extraordinary man she had ever met. Although Catherine was very interested in modern reform, she finally wrote, "Monsieur Diderot, I have listened with the greatest pleasure to all the inspirations flowing from your brilliant mind. But all your grand philosophies, which I understand very well, would do marvelously in books and very badly in practice. You work only on paper, which consents to anything. I, poor Empress, work on human skin, which is far more prickly and sensitive." Diderot, of course, didn't change his position. After he had returned to France, he published some new observations, and one of them said, "There is no sovereign except the nation. There can be no true legislator except the people." And he stated that people have the right to defy or depose a monarch. Diderot's last published book was a collaboration called History of the Two Indies. It was to be a survey of the European involvement in trade and conquest around the world. He deplored the system of colonization and especially the business of African slavery. Current thinking on this issue declared the black race inferior and even blamed the Africans for the trade in human beings. Diderot put the blame on European greed, not only the traders and planters, but ordinary people who profited from goods created by slave labor. He predicted a bloody uprising 10 years before Toussaint Louverture began the violent struggle for a free Haiti. Of course, another struggle was shaping up in the 1770s. Diderot was an Americaniste, a backer of American independence. We know he had corresponded with Benjamin Franklin, and they may have met, but there's no proof. That would have been an amazing conversation. He did meet Dr. Benjamin Rush, who would later be a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He read and translated Thomas Paine's Common Sense. He regretted being too old to travel to what he called the land of tolerance, morals, laws, virtue, and liberty. But he sent some advice which might be good for us today. "People of North America, beware the abundance of gold that brings about the corruption of morals and the scorn of law. Beware of an unbalanced distribution of wealth that will produce a small number of opulent citizens and a horde of citizens in poverty." By 1784, when he was 71 years old, which was an advanced age at the time, Diderot's letters show an unsteady scrawl. In fact, he himself diagnosed himself with a stroke, or apoplexy, as it was called. He fell into a delirium for 3 days, during which he characteristically never stopped talking, except for short periods of sleep. He rallied a bit. He had a new bed installed while joking, "My friends, you are giving yourself a lot of trouble for a piece of furniture that will only be used for 4 days." And indeed, it was within a day or two that his daughter visited him for the last time. His mind was still sharp, and she heard him state one of his lifelong principles: "The first step toward philosophy is incredulity." After his death, Diderot fell out of favor with the revolutionaries, who felt he didn't go far enough, and then with the Empire and Restoration, who felt he had gone too far. But on the next slide, we'll see, let's see. Oh, yes, so this is a poster attacking Diderot that has a picture of his supposed 13 mistresses. And then the next one, by the time the centenary of his death occurred, the 100th anniversary of his death, he was celebrated as a genius, and this is an event that with a full house celebrating him. And on the next slide, we'll see a statue that was erected of him on the trendy Boulevard Saint-Germain. Curran concludes this biography, "Writing in an era of powerful systems, Diderot's private thinking opened philosophy up to the irrational, the marginal, and other nonconformist points of view. His most important legacy is this cacophony of individual voices and ideas. Readers today continue to be amazed by his willingness to give a platform to the unthinkable and the uncomfortable, and to question all received authorities and standard practices, be they religious, political, or societal. His joyful and dogged quest for truth makes him the most compelling 18th century advocate of the art of thinking freely." And then I should mention, I was a French major back in the day, and even took a graduate course long ago on Diderot. So one of the many historical figures who would have been delightful to see on a talk show. Diderot and the Art of Thinking Freely. And that's where all the pictures come from there too. So it does have that. And with this type of book, don't worry, the last 100 pages are usually notes and bibliographies and so on. Yes, he's just a little bit lesser known than some of the others. We're more familiar with American figures like Paine or English figures like Locke and so on. And I think it's sometimes just interesting, just like with Franklin, to see the mind of someone who had this great diversity of interests in, you know, the everyday of how things work, and then great philosophical ideas about what is the best way to live and how can a society govern itself. Yeah, and there certainly was that was happening with Diderot, in that he, you know, he was part of this circle. But for instance, his own father never forgave him, and there was it was when he was in prison that he wrote to his father. His father said, "Served you right. You, how dare you question the Holy Church? You deserve this." So his family never really forgave him, and many people saw him as an incarnation of Satan. So there definitely was division. Of course, some of those people didn't have access to the printing presses as much as he did, but this was not widely accepted at the time. Knowing that is why he literally had cases full of writings that he kept and were only published after his death that people kept rediscovering.
Not in there.
Interesting. This definitely was true of some of the great people that we study now, that they, you know, they called it different things. I don't remember seeing anything about him having melancholy. Perhaps it was, maybe he was more of an ADD person. But he was obviously able to focus on things, to do things in great detail, if he was interested in them. And yes, thank you for being such a great audience. It's always delightful to have a group, as I mentioned to the kids. It's a group who wants to learn about things and find out something new. Final quote. Diderot said, "Posterity is to the philosophe as heaven is to the man of religion." So all of us have responsibility for that, keeping him in heaven by having him known to posterity.